Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this Saturday morning, September 26th, 2020. Glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 7 to 8 on WLIW 88.3 FM. And you can hear it online live at WLIW.org. And each show is archived on my website at AnneLiguori.com and distributed on podcasts. So glad you can join us and hope you're having a wonderful autumn weekend. It's just, I love this time of year. I already got my pumpkin, got the mums, and Indian summer, great golf weather. Really had a wonderful time playing in the Samuel Waxman Cancer Research Foundation charity golf outing this past Monday at Fresh Meadow Country Club. Just a gorgeous golf course, and everything about it is just so wonderful. And then on Tuesday, I had the opportunity to play in the East End Hospice charity golf tournament at Sabonic, and that was equally as just wonderful. It's just such a wonderful golf course, great people. A little chilly. There was a lot of wind. It was a little brisk, but sunny, and just really had a great day. So I love this time of year. Well, a lot of big sports stories and news stories. And the big sports story this past week with the passing of one of the greatest running backs in the history of the NFL, Gale Sayers, who played 7 seasons for the Chicago Bears. He died at his home in Indiana. He was 77. And before we go any further about Gale, I had the opportunity to sit down with him and do a sports interview TV show back in 1992. So I'm just really honored to be able to play the audio from this TV interview in this morning show. So that will be the first segment that you will hear. But I was able to find the show, get it digitized. Thank you, Historic Films, for digitizing this show so quickly for me, for turning that around. And then Kyle was able to extract the audio from the TV show and hopefully edit out all the commercials that ran back then in 1992. Oh my goodness, you should have seen my hairdo. Very funny looking. But anyway, so I'm going to play that interview of Gale Sayers this morning. And, he was just an outstanding individual on and off the field. And we talked a lot about how he prepared for life after football. He spent 7 seasons with the Chicago Bears. As I said, he died in his home in Indiana. He was 77. But, Gale Sayers was most known not only as a football player, but from the film Brian Song, the Emmy Award-winning television movie based on his friendship with his teammate Brian Piccolo, who died of cancer at the young age of 26. And Sayers' friendship with his teammate Brian Piccolo, who died back in 1970, inspired Sayers to write his autobiography, I Am Third, which was turned into the film. They adapted it for the film. So, the fact that, Sayers was able to write this, co-write this book, and in the interview, you'll hear him talk about everything he was involved with while he was playing football, because back then, he actually told me he made $25,000 a year, and they had to have a plan for life after football. And, then he became a stockbroker, and then he worked in athletic administration, and then he went into computers. So we talk a lot about, what he was doing while he was playing football, his life after football. And then, of course, we get into football, and he talks about George Halas, what it was like playing with George Halas. He had a father-son relationship with Coach Halas. He talked about, I asked him about his opinions on Mike Ditka, on Jim Brown, on Barry Sanders. It's just a real classic show. So all you sports historians and football fans and anybody who really appreciates history will enjoy my 1992 TV interview with Gale Sayers, which we will play in a few minutes. He led the league in yards rushing, receiving, run backs, 2,272 yards. He scored 22 touchdowns, six of them in one game. Was named to the All-League team for the first of five consecutive years. No professional player has done that since. Score six touchdowns in one game. And funny thing about that is he was taken out of that game early, and the team didn't really know about the record, the six touchdowns in one game. So, you know, he had said afterwards he could have probably scored even more touchdowns than that. So just unbelievable performer. And he was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame back in 1977. He was only 34 at the time, which I'm pretty sure he's still the youngest person to have received that honor. So he just was an exemplary person on and off the field, and just honored that I had a chance to talk to him when he came through Manhattan back in 1992. And then in the second half of the show, I'll replay an interview that I did with Brando Chambly of the Golf Channel. Brando used to play on the Pro Golf Tour. Then he got into television, and anybody who watches the Golf Channel obviously knows about Brando Chambly. He has very strong opinions. He's always a lot of fun to talk to. He's a friend of mine. He's not afraid to express his opinions, which I like. Some people take exception to some of the things he says. He's criticized Tiger and you know, some other marquee names out there. So he's taken a lot of heat for some of his statements. But, you know, he's very thoughtful. He does a lot of research. And I think you'll find Brando Chambly and his opinions fascinating. Obviously, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you can't say enough about her and what she did for women and men. You know, she's lied in state at the U.S. Capitol, and first woman so honored in American history to lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. And boy, what, you talk about a trailblazer for women. She was indeed a trailblazer among all trailblazers, right? This past week, I was reading an article in the New York Times which described one of the cases that Ruth Bader Ginsburg got behind very early in her career, which was helping a female tennis player in Teaneck, New Jersey, play on the boys' tennis team. And apparently the tennis player's mother had reached out to the American Civil Liberties Union, and Ginsburg was there as a volunteer lawyer. And so Ginsburg and her colleague there at the time, Anna Mae Shepherd, led the family to file a lawsuit in U.S. District Court in Newark, New Jersey, charging that the rules barring girls from competing alongside boys violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And at the time, Ginsburg was teaching at Rutgers Law School in Newark, and she was one of only a few female law professors in the U.S. at that time when she began working for the ACLU in New Jersey. And the Times went on to say in 1972, she co-founded the ACLU's Women's Rights Project, and they worked on just hundreds of gender discrimination cases. So, I mean, this woman was just unbelievable. All the barriers that she overcame and all the roadblocks she got through. And the story about her helping this woman tennis player in high school, the female high school tennis player, resonated with me because I played on the boys' tennis team when I was in high school in Brecksville, Ohio. And at the time, there was no girls' tennis team. So thankfully, I never had an issue with being allowed to play in the boys' tennis team. And I had a very successful 4 years on the guys' tennis team, playing the only woman playing with all guys against guys in the conference. But, you know, I know that other girls who tried to play on boys' teams, whether or not they had a girls' team or not, you know, obviously met a lot of challenges. So I was thankful that at least I was able to play in the boys' tennis team. They allowed me to do that back then. All right. Well, the U.S. Open Championship at Wingfoot last week was most successful, despite the fact that there were no spectators. And Bryson DeChambeau just blasted the ball off the tee, scrambled from the rough, made putts to win his first major title. DeChambeau, he's 27 years old. He was the only player under par on Sunday. He shot a 367. And with his overall score of 6 under for the championship, he beat 21-year-old Matthew Wolff by 6 shots. Louis Oosthuizen came in third. Harris English came in fourth. Xander Schauffele was a plus four, finished fifth. Dustin Johnson and Will Zalatoris from the Korn Ferry Tour, they finished at plus five, and they tied for sixth. Rory McIlroy finished with a plus six. So all these scores over par. Rory, that was good enough for a tie for eighth with Tony Finau, Justin Thomas, Webb Simpson, and Zach Johnson. And I'm telling you all these, how these other top players finished, because, you know, it was just outstanding that DeChambeau was able to shoot a low number on Sunday and win with a score of six under, and being under par at Wingfoot during a U.S. Open is just rare, as we talked about last week. And as you heard with my interview 2 weeks ago with Hale Irwin, who won the U.S. Open back in 1974 at Wingfoot with a score of plus seven. So anyway, I'm happy that Bryson DeChambeau won. He's unconventional. He bulked up 30, 40 pounds, works out regularly with a trainer, all in the name of increasing his clubhead speed in order to hit the ball further. And his short game's incredible. And he made putts on those treacherous greens at Wingfoot. So, and he's a workhorse. He'd go back to the range after he played, you know, the round on Thursday and Friday and Saturday. And he'd keep working on a swing. And when the temperature dropped Thursday after he played, he went back to the range at night and worked on a swing to see how the cooler temperatures would affect the distance of the ball. So he's a scientist. He was a physics major. And he applies all that knowledge to the game. And a lot of people argue, as critics say, you know, his long game is making these golf courses, you know, look bad or making these golf courses obsolete. You know, but look, he hits the ball so far. He didn't find the fairways. I mean, his percentage was low finding the fairways, but he was able to scramble out of the greens with a, you know, shorter iron and, you know, with a wedge. And then you have to make the putt and score. You still have to do that to win, which he did. So congratulations to Bryson DeChambeau. And I like his originality. And I think, you know, the sport is better for it. So good for him. A foursome of British Open champions accepted invitations to become honorary members of the Royal and Ancient Golf Club at St. Andrews. And a woman, Catriona Matthew, got in, which I'm happy to see. She's from Scotland. She won the 2009 British Open at Royal Lytham and St. Anne's in 2009 and has 11 pro victories. Ernie Els, Padraig Harrington, Nick Price, they are all invited to become honorary members of the RNA as well. So congratulations to them. In college football, the Pac-12 will start a seven-game season on November 6th. They join the Big Ten and the Mountain West. 9 of 10 FBS conferences are ready to have their seasons completed by December 20th. That's the day the College Football Playoff Selection Committee is scheduled to pick teams to play for the national championship and in various bowl games. Good for them. Two other news items I want to get in quickly here. In Major League Baseball, this is the final weekend of the regular season. Eight teams in the National League are vying for four available postseason spots. So we'll see what happens this weekend. The teams still in contention are the Marlins, the Phillies, the Cardinals, the Reds, the Brewers, and the San Francisco Giants. The Mets and the Rockies could advance to the postseason, but they need all wins in the remaining games. And in the American League, only one playoff spot remains open. With the Mariners' loss last Sunday, the Yankees officially clinched their 22nd playoff berth in the past 26 seasons. They are the fifth American League team to clinch a spot in the 2020 postseason, joining the White Sox, the Tampa Bay Rays, the Oakland A's, and the Minnesota Twins. And finally, the French Open in Paris begins tomorrow. Rafael Nadal, 34 years old, from Spain, you all know Rafi, he's going for a 13th French Open title. Just unbelievable when you think about it. And that would extend his own record for the most singles trophies won by anyone in any major tennis tournament. It would be his 20th Grand Slam title if he could win the French Open, tying Roger Federer's record. Federer has been out for the season after two operations on his right knee. This major, Roland Garros, is the last major this season. They are only allowing 1,000 spectators per day there. which was recently cut back from 5,000 a day with the pandemic scare happening over there. All right, let's get to these billboards, and then we will get to my interview from 1992 with the great Gale Sayers. May he rest in peace. We send prayers to his family as well. He just passed away this week. Sports Interview with Anne Liguori is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and My Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, zero distortion, patent dual zone lens technology. Learn more at Peak Vision, PEAKVision.com. We're here with Gale Sayers, NFL Hall of Famer, 8 NFL records, 15 Chicago Bear records, and a businessman.
Thank you.
These days, right? Are you most proud of the post-football career? You've done so much since your playing days.
No question about that, because football had a God-given talent. Yes, I had to work to hone that talent, but it came very, very easy for me. In the business world, different ball game.
Really?
I never scored anywhere near 6 touchdowns on this business field. So I enjoy my post-football career more than my football career, although I enjoyed it very much.
Take us through, we're going to talk all about your football career, but take us through the post-football career. You only played 6 years in the NFL, and we'll get into that in a minute, but just because you've done so much, if you can tell us the whole shebang.
Well, after football, I went back to the University of Kansas as assistant athletic director. I went back and got my master's degree in education. Then from there, I went to Southern Illinois University as athletic director. I was there for 5 years, from 1976 to 1981. Then after that, I moved back to Chicago and started my own company, Crest Computers and Supplies, and I've been doing that for 10 years now. And besides that, I'm on the National Board of Junior Achievement, Boy Scouts of America, Boys and Girls Club, and things like that. And
you certainly make a difference everywhere you go. I mean, during football, you did the post-career in business. But why all of a sudden computers? Why your own company?
Well, when I played the game, there was life after football. Because when I played, I played for $25,000 a year. I was the third person picked the entire draft, $25,000 a year. The day that third person picked got a $2.5 million signing bonus. Forget the salary, he got a signing bonus for $2.5 million. So there was life after football. So I had to plan for a life after football. I said so many times, as you prepare yourself to play, you must prepare yourself to quit. And I did that. So I did a number of things. I was a stockbroker. I was in athletic administration. Now I'm in computers. And so I'm doing what I want to do.
That's great advice, especially for players that are just starting their NFL seasons. I mean, the average career for a football player, pro football player, is less than 6 years.
It's 3 years. That's all. The average is only 3 years, and you have to prepare to quit. But again, even now with the big salaries, many don't prepare to quit. The ones that will never have to work again in their lives, they're in the minority. The majority will one day have to get out there and get a job, but they still don't prepare to quit. They think they're going to play 5, 10, 15, 20 years. It's not that long of a career. It's a 3-year proposition. That's all. It's not 20 years. It's 3 years, but they still don't believe it. I'm going to play 25 years. It's not going to happen for them.
Now, I know starting your own company probably, you say, is tougher than anything you've mm-hmm. ever done. Even tougher, you know, you think of an athlete and you think, well, you know, that's a lot of work. But you're saying most of that was talent, that you really didn't have to work that hard?
There is nothing hard about a Michael Jordan dunking a basketball or shooting a jump shot. It wasn't nothing hard about Kareem Jabbar, a hook shot. You know, those are God-given talents. Yes, you work hard.
Well, Larry Bird had to work, though.
Yeah, he worked at it, but he was a lot of God-given talent too. Magic Johnson passing the ball behind his head. Yes, he worked at that, but it came easy for him. Yes, you got beat up, you got tired, you got bruised, but it was very, very easy. In the business world, I had to learn about computers. I had to go to school and learn about, you know, networking and integration and what goes in the computer. But in football, all I had to do is get out there and play. I never had to work on a move say fake left and go right, or fake right and go left. Nothing like that. Just got myself in shape and went out there and played.
That's interesting, because Jim Brown says he doesn't even put his trophies out in his house. He's most proud of the American program that he's working on now. And are you the same way? Do you kind of dismiss everything, your incredible career, those 6 years?
I have many, many fond memories about playing the game of football, whether it's high school, grade school, college, or pro, because many things I had today, I owe to football. I will never, ever forget about my playing days on the football field. But, you know, life goes on. I know so many players out there today always talking about what they did in 1965 or what they did in 1975. They're living in yesterday times, you know. And so I just think that you have to go on with doing other things.
How realistic is it that one day the NFL will have more black coaches?
Well, eventually they will have more minority coaches, no question about it, because right now I think 65% of the NFL are minority players. But the thing about it, you have to understand, you're looking at 28 jobs. You're not looking at 3,000 or 30,000. It's 28 teams in the league. You're talking about 28 jobs. So why even try for one of those jobs? You know, there's so many other things you can do in the world. But to try to be a head coach on one of the 28 teams or assistant coach on one of the 28 teams, it probably will not happen. And the thing about it, you have to prepare to be a head coach or to be assistant coach. You can't just, because you're a good player, come out and say, I'm going to be a running back coach, or I'm going to be a defensive line coach. You have to study the game. You have to know offense, defense, special teams, the whole thing. And the thing about it, today's player, he's making $800,000, $900,000, $1 million a year. Come back to be assistant coach, you make it $60,000 a year. Now, if you're living at that lifestyle of $1 million a year, two homes, three cars, kids in private school, you can't make it on $60,000 a year. So you have to do something else. So you have to prepare for it. When I say prepare for it, number one, live it a lifestyle that if you want to be a coach, now if you're living in a $100,000 lifestyle, $75,000 lifestyle, and you're making $65,000, yes, now you can handle it. But if you live in this big lifestyle up here, and all of a sudden making $60,000, it doesn't work.
So you're saying just be realistic about it.
Yes.
You're not really discouraging
people
who want to become coaches.
And the thing about it, you know, you have 47 players on each team. You think 47 players don't want to be coaches? You only get 12 coaches.
Sure.
They all can't be coaches. You know, they should learn to do other things.
What about you? Did you ever want to become a coach?
Never wanted to become a coach. That's a passive part of football. Coaching, I felt today's player wouldn't do the things that made Gale Sayers a good football player. I wouldn't ask them to do anything more, but I don't think they would do the things that make themselves as good as Gale Sayers was. And so I couldn't handle that.
Was that your own decision, or did you figure at that point, especially when you played, there's no way a black man could become a coach?
No, I was deeper than that, number one. My second year in pro football, I became a stockbroker. You know, I did radio and TV. I did many other things. I wanted to prepare for that day when I couldn't play anymore, and I didn't want them to give me anything. I didn't want a token job as a public relations man or coach. I wanted something substantial. And so I prepared to do other things. Some players prepare to be coaches. Some don't prepare to do anything. Then once their career is over, they say, give me a job. And it doesn't work that way. You have to have some skills.
We're back with Gale Sayers, who set many records in the NFL, many records with the Bears. When you were a rookie, 6 touchdowns in one game, 22 in one season. The list goes on. However, what's most impressive to me about you is this whole notion of this overachiever that was part of you even when you were an athlete.
You know, yes, you know, athletes today prepare probably 6 to 8 months a year at their profession, whether it's football, basketball, baseball. But still, you have to have in the back of your mind, what are you going to do when your career is over?
Well, you did that, but how many? There are very few athletes who are like you.
Very few.
And back when you played, too, maybe now more educated that, you know, these rookies, they have all these rookie programs now, all these leagues trying to educate them. But When you played, that I have a feeling that you were very much of an individual compared to your teammates.
Right. You know, I didn't go with the masses. You know, I followed Gale Sayers, you know, simple as that. But, you know, I was probably one of maybe 15 athletes that understood that football is a very short-term proposition and that you had to prepare to quit. And I did that.
Now, why do you think you developed that kind of attitude early? Did you have a, was your father you know, a taskmaster as far as, I mean, what develops that kind of personality?
When you listen, you learn, and when you talk, you teach. I listen a lot. I was a very, very shy individual, and I listened to the people I believed in. I listened to a person like a Buddy Young that helped me sign with the Bears, a George Halas, who was my coach, and was 50 years older than Gale Sayers, and I listened to him on different matters. But you have to, you know, and athletes today, they do know. They know these statistics of playing professional football and baseball and basketball. They know it's short term, but yet and still, many of them don't think it will ever end, and it does end.
Talk about George Halas a little bit. What's it like playing?
George Halas was a tremendous individual. We had a father-son relationship. I don't know why, when I came to the Bears, this man was 69 years of age, coaching professional football, 69 years of age. And, you know, I've said so many times that I could go out and run as hard as I could every play for George Halas, because here's a man 69 years of age, and we had some very cold winters in Chicago in 1965, 66, 67. He's the first one on the field, the last one to leave the field. And I would do anything for George Halas. I respected that man that much.
I have these visions of him with just all this stuff coming out of his mouth in the coldest days in the winter.
Well, he was a tough individual, but very, very compassionate. You know, people say he was tight-fisted and things like that. If you saw the movie Brian Sloan, when Brian Piccolo died of cancer, his hospital bills came to over $500,000. The old man took care of the whole shot. Didn't have to do anything about that. Brian has had three daughters. They all graduated from Wake Forest University. The old man took care of all that. Didn't have to do it. A very, very compassionate man.
That movie, well, Brian's mm-hmm. song, mm-hmm. really showed other dimensions of you as well. And I know when you got the George Halas Award in May of 1970, there was a ceremony given mm-hmm. to the league's most courageous player. Mm-hmm. Now, you got that award.
Yes.
And instead of accepting the honor, you said, in quotes, "I tell you now, I accept this award for Brian Piccolo, a man of courage who should receive it. It is mine tonight, but Brian Piccolo will have it tomorrow. When you hit your knees tonight, please ask God to let him live."
Mm-hmm. Well, it was something I felt, you know, had to be done at that time, because, hey, again, football is my life. Me coming back, leading the league in rushing, making All-Pro again, that was, again, that was my game. It was very easy. But the thing, the kind of disease that Brian had, and his courageous fight for life, it was something, you know, and it affected not only Gale Sayers but all the teammates on the Bears, really the whole National Football League, because he really thought that he had it won, and it didn't happen for him. And the thing about his disease, when he had that disease, the type of cancer he had, it was a 10% cure rate. Today is 95%. You know, so some things are being done, but I felt that it had to be done, and I felt that, you know, I had to make people understand that, you know, there's somebody else out there that's more deserving of this award than Gale Sayers, because football wasn't easy for Gale Sayers, and I'm fighting off a knee injury. He's fighting for his life, and he lost that.
3 weeks after you delivered that speech?
He died.
He died. Mm-hmm. Did that hit you harder than anything in your life?
Well, at the time it did. You know, three things were very, very important to Gale Sayers during that time: football, football, and football. Simple as that. You know, I didn't care about anything else, because I wanted to play football. And when that happened to Brian, and his sickness and his eventual death, you know, it makes you start thinking about other things. Thinking about, is this game worth it? You know, is it that important? You know, then you start thinking about, well, I better spend more time with my family. I better start doing other things, because you never know. He died at 26 years of age. That's very, very young to die, and life's not promised to you, you know. And so he was healthy as anybody, and all of a sudden, he's gone.
Gale, you talked about your respect and admiration for George Halas. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about Mike Ditka, who's been part of the Bears organization now for a long time, and what do you think of him?
Well, you know, I played with Mike Ditka. Very, very tough competitor, just as tough as a coach. Mike would do anything to win, and he wants to win in the same way he is as a coach. And so I like Mike Ditka. You know, he's from the old school. You know, give me 100% effort all the time. We're paying you $1 million a year. Give me that effort. Don't give me 80%. Don't give me 75%. Give me 100% of the effort. And, hey, I'm happy with you. When you see him yelling on the sidelines, he's not yelling at the players who are putting out 100%. He's yelling at the players who are putting out 75% or 80%. And he knows when they're putting out that kind of effort. So, no, I think he's a great coach. He's done a great job for the Bears, won one Super Bowl, won 6 or 7 divisional titles. That's all you can ask of a coach. That's all you can ask. You don't ask him to win 10 Super Bowls. You ask him to be competitive, get in the playoffs, having a chance to win. He's done that.
What did you think of Jim Brown?
Jim Brown, when I came up, he was the number one running back in the league. I respected Jim Brown. I wasn't the kind of a person that asked for an autograph, but I looked at Jim Brown and said to myself, how can I be better than Jim Brown? Because he was the number one man. When I came up in 1965, Jim was the top running back of all time. And I want to know, how could I be better? And I worked at being better. And so, but he, in my estimation, number one running back of all times. You can talk about Walter Payton. You can talk about O.J. Simpson. You can talk about Eric Dickerson. You can talk about a lot of them. But Jim Brown, in my opinion, is the best of all times.
So if Jim Brown's number one, where would Gale Sayers be in that list that you just mentioned?
Probably 1A.
Good answer. You've taken a couple tests before in school, right? A, B, C, all the above. What do you think of Barry Sanders?
I like him. He reminds me of Gale Sayers, the way he runs. I think he's very, very exciting. I would pay to go see him play. Very few other players I would pay to play, see play. I would pay to see him play because he's very, very exciting. He does a lot of things that I love to see in a running back. Very, very tough individual.
I want to talk about some of the other things you're doing. I know you've developed a new program with the CFA. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell me about it?
Well, this is called the Hitachi Promise of Tomorrow program. It's a scholarship program for college football players. And we're trying to develop teachers. Our educational system in this country is in very, very bad shape. We need more qualified teachers. And the program will give $5,000 scholarships to student athletes who want to go into the teaching profession.
Obviously, you want to make a difference as far as student athletes go, mm-hmm. and educating them, which is something that needs to be done not only in football but in all sports. But many athletes today making the big bucks don't feel like they need to be role models. They don't think that they should have that responsibility.
Well, it's very, very sad because if you think that you're not a role model, you might well not even be breathing. Because the thing about it, why do young kids want to walk like you and dress like you and jump like you and shoot like you? You know, there's more kids dribbling basketballs with their tongues hanging out trying to look like Michael Jordan today than any in history. You know, we are role models. And, you know, we owe it to the children to come back and tell them that, yes, it's great to be a professional athlete, but for the most part, you're not going to make it. You know, do something with your life. You know, prepare for the future. You know, get your degree, get your high school diploma, get your college degree. And we have to do things like that. And I just hope that we can encourage athletes, football players, to become teachers.
Sports Interview with Anne Liguori is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and My Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, zero distortion, patented dual zone lens technology. Learn more at Peak Vision, PEAKVision.com. Welcome back, Randall, former PGA Tour player who has been with the Golf Channel since 2004, serves as both a studio and on-site analyst. Welcome, Randall.
Nice to join you this morning, Ann. How are you?
I am good. Well, let's get right into it.
Okay.
I really respect you as a broadcaster. I think the game needs colorful commentators who are, you know, who aren't afraid to share their strong opinions. And you are known as one of the game's most respected analysts, and your outspoken opinions make you one of the industry's most controversial personalities. Some of your critics, though, say you do it for ratings and attention. I mean, how do you answer those critics, Brandel?
Well, I say I never say anything just to be provocative. You know, I say things that I believe to be true, that people may find provocative. And I think that's sort of the nuance. A famous English playwright by the name of Noel Coward once said that people are shocked by honesty, but not by deceit. And I think, you know, by and large, you know, there's some truth to that. But my job as an analyst is to try to be accurate, try to be fair, and then try to tell our audience something that they haven't heard all day. You know, by the time I come on the air at, you know, whatever time, 6:30, 7 o'clock at night, I joke that everything that could be said about the golf has already been said about the golf. So, you know, I spend all day long watching to try to think of something that might be interesting to our audience, and then I try to share it with them. And I spend probably most of my time lauding the players. But occasionally, you know, it seems like once a week, something will pop up that is, you know, fairly controversial, not quite as controversial as the clip that you just played. You know, that was a little unprecedented in the world of golf. Incidents like that don't often happen and sort of present themselves in video form that, in my view, were fairly convincing. You know, but most of the time I'm lauding the players. But the human nature being what it is, you know, I could spend an hour with somebody telling them how beautiful they are, nice they are, but then tell them you don't like their shoes, and that's all they'll remember.
Well, let's start with Patrick Reed, since we did come out with that cut of your talking about Patrick Reed. And, you know, you referred to him on the air. You actually didn't say as a cheater. You actually said to defend what Patrick Reed did is to defend cheating, which I thought was at least a softer approach. But obviously, well, you know what you meant. So.
Yeah, you know, I mean, looking at the video, I actually wasn't working the week of the hero. I was off that week. I believe it was Q School, actually. I was trying to get my card for the Champions Tour. But, you know, I came back the next week and was working. And so the video pops up because it's the, you know, it's the President's Cup. And, you know, I thought that it would impact the team. I thought it would be sort of disorienting to the team because it forced everybody to sort of, you know, protect the comments that were coming his way because they were protecting the team. It was odd. But really, I thought there was two ways to look at that. Was it his problem or was it the game's problem? Because it's you know, it has happened in the game that players, you know, occasionally pop up and do something that is a flagrant violation of the rule. But normally the game sort of takes care of that particular player, either scorn from players or disinterest from sponsors. But there's an accounting of that. You can't quite do something that's, you know, that flagrant, in my view, it's that flagrant, without getting some repercussions. But the larger picture was, is this a sort of a trend in the game of golf? Because the game has always been about self-governing, self-policing. I mean, that is what gives the game its greater interest. Or is this a trend in the game, sort of a catch-me-if-you-can mentality? Have we gone from self-governing to catch-me-if-you-can? And if the latter is true, well, then that's, you know, that's upsetting, because the great thing about this game is that it has always had sort of steadfast traditions that, by and large, the people that play it sort of adhere to. If you and I go out and play, and we have a couple of friends with us, and we all hit it all over the fairway, everybody trusts everybody in the group to play by the rules. Otherwise, the game's going to fall apart, and camaraderie is the best thing about this game. You can't. You're not all on a court. You're not all on a diamond where everybody's watching everybody. You're off in the trees or a bunker, and everybody needs to trust everybody. And that was the larger issue. I felt like that it was a teachable moment to the young boys and girls watching the game. That you know, we need to talk now about the traditions of this game. And so look, that's the way I framed it, and that's the way I understood it, or tried to anyway.
Well, we played a cut earlier in the show of Brooks Koepka, who said, you know, patting down the grass or the sand goes on a little bit more than people think. So to your point, yeah, to your point, I mean, are we getting away from the integrity of the game, or people just trying to get away with what they can get away with?
Well, it has always been, you know, I mean, again, the traditions of this game, by and large, have been great, and they do give it its vitality. But there's always been a handful of players, which is inevitable when you have 200-300 people competing in professional sports. Whatever the sport is, you're going to have a few that are going to try to fudge here or there. But the thing is that everybody in the history of the game knows who those players are. They don't talk about it much on the air. You know, by and large, whatever they did didn't make it to video and didn't get on TV. So it was always just sort of a whispered hush-hush, you know, and everybody in the game of golf knows who they were. You know, so, and that's the reputation a player doesn't want, you'd like to think. But now then, you know, there's video everywhere. So it's very hard for somebody to do something that is so flagrant if they're a good player, because they're mostly on TV.
That's right. You just
but outside of that, I mean, again, the game takes care of those players just through sort of scorn, generally speaking.
Now, I know you got a cease and desist letter from his lawyer demanding that you stop referring to Reed as a cheater. So what were the ramifications of that, Randall?
Well, I mean, if he tried to cease and desist everybody, you know, talking about this, my goodness, the courtroom would be filled. So I wasn't the only one. I was just happened to be the only one that week for the most part. But since then, I mean, I think Brooks Koepka came out with comments that were pretty poignant on this matter, along with several other players and now several other commentators. So, you know, look, I mean, it you know, I gave the letter its due attention. I sent it to the proper attorneys, and you know, they let me know that I was, you know, at least from their perspective, that I was in my right lane. But you know, if it goes any further, certainly I have plenty of my older brother owns a law firm of you know, considerable prestige. So you know, there's no shortage of lawyers that contacted me. But again, you know, I felt like I was just doing my job, which was to, as accurately as I could, frame this discussion, and hopefully that it, you know, it goes away. That, you know, this is a learning moment for Patrick, and you know, on the golf course, he conducts himself a little bit better than what we saw at the Hero.
Let's talk about. We'll move to another comment that got a lot of attention. Your most recent comments about, in quote, golf teachers being exposed for their idiocy, saying that, in quote, flawed teaching philosophies end more careers than help, end quote. Do you regret those comments at all, or take any of those back?
Well, I regret a few of the words. I would like to have tackled myself on a few of those words, but, you know.
And you did apologize for the vulgar term.
No, I mean, you know, talking about golf is a lot like playing golf. Sometimes you know, you make a bogey or two. But in general, my comments were about two or three teachers that were prevalent on the PGA Tour. And because they were so prevalent and in vogue, their ideas populated a lot of teaching. Not all of it, you know. I mean, the world of teaching is, just here in the United States, upwards of 30,000 people. I don't presume to say that that's the lion's share of them were adopting these ideas, but certainly the higher profile, a lot of the higher profile teachers were in favor of sort of a centered head position or even a left-leaning head position, maintaining that on the backswing, restricted lower body movement, clubs in front, you know, arms in front of you, restricted arm turn. And you know, I mean, that proliferated teaching for the better part of 30 years. And you know, my argument was that, look, YouTube made it very easy for somebody to stand on a range, pull up videos of, you know, every generation of players, even the best players now, and say, well, I don't see that represented amongst the greats. And so I think, you know, the pendulum in at least not all teaching, but you know, amongst tour players, it has changed. You know, there's no more this idea that you need to swing around a centered head. Everybody knows, every single teacher in the world now, you know, knows that's a hard position to maintain because there's so much evidence available to the contrary. You know, there's not a single great player that doesn't move laterally in their backswing. So, you know, my comments were really directed at just, you know, to a handful of teachers. And look, I took lessons from these teachers. I took these lessons. I stood on the range and tried to do these things. And you know, you're standing there talking to somebody who's on the cover of magazines, who's voted the best teacher here or there. And my beef really is with, you know, not only just the ideas that they were teaching, but the fact that there's not an objective way to judge teachers. And I don't want to do that to castigate any teachers. I want to know who the really the best are. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at, well, just look at the top 50 teacher rankings. I mean, you go back to 2010 to 2020, there's been one person at the top. Now, I'm not saying that Butch Harmon isn't a great teacher. He certainly is. Fabulous teacher. But there's only been one player named number one in the last 10 years. There's been 10 different number ones in men's professional golf. So to think that, you know, the same people sort of populate these lists, to me, it does a disservice to the 27,000 other men and women in the PGA of America when we could use objective criteria to judge who the best teachers are. And if
and many of them who are best at marketing themselves and getting that attention, as you say, on social media, you know, obviously their names are going to stand out, and that could persuade, you know, these magazines to name them in the top 100. You know, and I do tend to agree with your notion that modern golf instruction is robbing players of that natural athleticism. I mean, many of these young players you see out there, whether professionally or playing college golf, they have these kind of robotic-like swings. Every swing looks identical to each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think less and less so. I mean, you know, we're beginning to see, you know, young players come out with, highly idiosyncratic golf swings that have a lot of movement to them and a lot of power. But, you know, the top 50 being populated by teachers who either work with tour players or having an affiliation with a magazine, again, it doesn't necessarily disqualify them, but is it enough to convince me that they are indeed amongst the top 50 teachers? And, you know, look, to the PGA of America's credit, they are coming out this summer, or they were, and we'll see if it comes out. I mean, there's obviously a lot of uncertainty in the world right now, but there was scheduled to come out this sort of objective way to judge teachers, which, again, there's all kinds of metrics, objective metrics that, you know, the world of golf can be using to judge teachers. And look, there can still be this subjective list, you know, who we think there is, but there should also be an objective list. Because I would like to know who's having the most success in the world of teaching, because I think it would better the game of golf. There's such an intrinsic value to the game of golf. I don't necessarily want to know who can gain the most money teaching. I don't begrudge them for making that money, but I want to know who is having the most success with average golfers. You know, there may be somebody out there teaching on grass mats in Montana who's had incredible success taking 20 handicappers to 12s in a year. But we don't know because, you know, they're not on a PGA Tour driving range, or they don't have an affiliation with a magazine. So there needs to be at least two lists, in my view, one that's not as political or subjective and one that is more objective.
Brando, let's talk about Jordan Spieth. You had some critical things to say about his swing and his instructor, Cameron McCormick. I mean, here's a guy, Spieth, who just had incredible success when he first started out, you know, winning the Masters, the U.S. Open in 2015, the Open Championship in 2017. And, you know, his ranking has dropped outside of the top 50 last I looked. I mean, do you think Jordan's issues are swing issues, or is it more mental, or a combination of both? I personally think he just overanalyzes on everything, and he puts so much expectation on himself, obviously because of his early success. But what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think it's easy to look at, you know, his golf swing now versus when he was playing his best golf and point out differences and say, there it is, you know, there's the differences. Why doesn't he just go back to that? But I think those are more the symptoms than the cause. To me, the cause is, you know, in my view, it would be the lack of clarity that produces the best movements. And I'm convinced that if he had, you know, some clarity, some stillness, some quiet on the driving range, that he would find his way towards the shot patterns, the release patterns, and the athletic movements that he previously had. When he was playing his best golf, he had, you know, a slight kick to his golf swing, you know, a trigger move to begin his golf swing. I mean, that's common amongst almost every single great player that's ever played. Some trigger move that says, you know, we're an athlete. And then, you know, obviously he had different movement patterns in his golf swing completely than he has right now. But I think he would find those more easily if he were in an atmosphere of quiet and stillness. You know, we're on the set at Live From, and, you know, we watch before they tee off and after they tee off. And we watch Monday through Sunday every single shot. And so, yeah, we see the sort of frantic look of teacher and coach relationship between Jordan and his coach. And it's not to say that Cameron's not a good teacher. Certainly is a good teacher. Butch Harmon worked with four players that ascended to number one spot in the world, and all of them fired him. It's not that they fired him because he was a bad teacher. It's like they just wanted a different set of ideas. You know, it just happens that, you know, ideas are not as fresh, the movements aren't working, you need to go get a second opinion. And, you know, that's just not unusual in the world of teaching. But, you know, I mean, like, I give Jordan a lot of credit for his loyalty, but when it comes to his golf game, and I think generally speaking, the best players, they need some quiet to find their genius, so to speak. And
well, why again, do these guys, Brando, why do they tinker with their swings? I mean, they're always looking for perfection, you know, whether it's Jordan or a Tiger or whomever. But why, you know, try to change something if they're, you know, if it was so successful for them? I mean, I don't know why Jordan, why is he changing his swing?
Yeah, I mean, the enticements are there, you know, that there's a luxury now because, you know, they can all afford to have teachers around. And the idea on paper sounds good, right? And have somebody there constantly to watch you, to videotape you, to sort of keep the pendulum from swinging, you know, widely to sort of off the game to, you know, to another movement over here to sort of get back to where you are, and then you overdo the movement. So on paper, it sounds good. But you think about it, if you had a teacher around you constantly, nobody's going to swing perfect. There's always going to be some aesthetic ideal that you would want to get to. Looking through the video camera, it's never going to look perfect. So there would always be this tendency to want to change it. You know, I recently did this show with Nick Doherty at Sky Sports where Rory came on and sort of talked us through the stretch at the Players Championship 2019. And I thought it was interesting that Rory said, and Rory, again, he goes to the golf tournaments without his coach. His coach is, he certainly still, you know, works with Michael Bannon and so forth, but he doesn't have him on site. And early that week, he said that, you know, his change of direction was too steep. And rather than try to change it, he just played with the shot pattern that steepness gave him, which was a left-to-right shot pattern. So the benefit of that was that he could get up on 16 and take it over the trees without worrying about it going left, and that he could, you know, get on 18 and take it at the water like he did on Sunday, Saturday, all week long. He took aggressive lines off 18. Without worrying about it going left. So he just played with this quote-unquote fault and made the best of it. And I
let
and
me
I
ask you, yeah. Let me, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I only have like a minute and a half, so we could talk for hours. Let's get to Tiger, because I know You've been critical of, you know, his swing changes as well. What are your latest thoughts on Tiger? I know you said back in 2018 that he got the least out of his talent more than anyone in history.
Yeah, well, I just said he left a lot on the table more than any player in history, because if he hadn't decided to change his golf swing in 98 to 2000, and then again from 2003 to 2005, and then again from 2010 to 2012, his win rate, you could have easily accumulated, you know, double-digit victories on the PGA Tour, and, you know, could have easily got him 25 major championships.
But I thought he changed his swing because of all the injuries, Brandel.
That's hard to say. I mean, people will love to say that the swing caused the injuries. His workout routine, even recently, Tiger said that his running caused his injuries. So I don't have any doubt that his workouts and his running caused his injuries. I never quite understood his workout routine. But again, I mean, we're talking about the guy who's played the greatest golf of all time, and they'll be talking about him 500 years from now if they're still playing golf. He came along and did things nobody could ever imagine. There was always a rub in this game. If golf gave you great ball striking, then you struggled to run his short game. If you had a great short game like Seve and Phil, then you were inaccurate off of the tee or not that precise. Tiger came along and he had, you know, Crenshaw's putting and Seve scrambling and Phil scrambling and Nicklaus's length and with his irons, Hogan's control. So you look at Tiger and you're like, well, there's no statistics that can sum this guy up. You can't get your arms around the circumference of his talent. It's just, but it was mind-boggling to me that he would change that technique. And then once he got back on form, he'd change it again. And once he got back on form, he'd change it again. So, I mean, that's part of his legend and, enigmatic talent that he was. He was never satisfied with the status quo, even when he dominated.
Brandel, promise me you'll come back on. There's never enough time. And real quickly,
real pleasure.
With the Golf Channel moving operations to Connecticut, will that affect you at all or no?
Sure, certainly. Yes, of course. I mean, at the very least, I'll be spending a lot of time in Connecticut, and perhaps I'll move up there. I'm not quite sure yet how that's going to play out, but definitely I'll be spending a lot more time up north. That's for sure.
Well, give Bailey my best, and
thank you, Ann. That's very nice.
Come on again.
I will do it. Thank you very much for what you do for the game of golf, Ann.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Always
Bye-bye.
A pleasure talking to you, Brandel Chamblee. I hope you enjoyed listening to my 1992 interview with the great late Gail Sayers from my Sports Interview with Ann Liguori cable show. And I hope you enjoyed hearing the interview that I did with the Golf Channel's Brandel Chamblee. My thanks to Kyle Lynch in the studio. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Be safe, be smart, be nice. I'll talk to you next Saturday morning from 7 to 8 right here on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.